Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Laura Chan Baker.
Hello.
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 Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, like a fantastic sandwich of sorts. So we get to see all sides of the process. I just felt I had to mix that up a bit. I read this paragraph at the same time every week. I just wanted to, I don't know.
You're in a weird mood this morning. I like it.
Thank you. Every week, we come together in the broken down combi van that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we are going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing how an artist's social networks affect their fame, the Instagram era of book design, and what happens when your work is also your hobby. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest, Jess Cruikshank. Jess is a brilliantly talented letterer and illustrator living in Sydney. Originally a designer working in advertising, she joined the Jackie Winter roster in 2015 and has been drawing for her supper ever since. Jess's work can be seen across a variety of media, from editorial illustrations to hand-painted typefaces to murals and animated GIFs. Most recently, she's been working on lots of book covers, a natural fit for her double threat skill of both lettering and illustration. Some publishers she's worked for include Penguin Random House, HarperCollins, Hachette, and Simon Schuster, and more. We're so excited to have her with us today, especially because she often gives the best food for thought on our various Slack channels. Jess, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, how are you going?
Good. I am buzzing because I've had too much coffee, but other than that, all good.
Jess, I just want to raise publicly, recorded on the podcast, did you have to get a babysitter for your dog today so that he wouldn't bark while we recorded?
Oh my God. So I had him booked into doggy daycare, but they wouldn't confirm. So then I had to get another friend to work from home to take him for the day. But she loves him and he loves her. So it's a good situation.
Your life has changed so much since you got Phoenix because he won't let you do anything. And it's kind of hilarious from the outside, but he is very cute. So it makes up for it.
He gets me out of the house, which is great when you're working from home.
That's very true.
We are a dog-friendly podcast.
Oh, big time.
And yeah, also, you remember that podcast bingo sheet that we saw once? And
oh, yeah.
You got to have the barking dog.
Got to have the barking dog, sirens in the background. Oh, yeah.
Laura, how are you going?
I had a near-death experience.
Tell me more.
I fell off my bike. It was really, don't worry, guys, I'm okay. I survived. No, but like, actually, I did smack my head on the concrete. Like, I went head first flying over the handlebars. It was pretty scary. But now I've got like a fun graze and a few bruises to show for it. A security guard saw me fall. That was really embarrassing. But other than that, I'm pretty good. How are you doing, Jeremy?
Fine. My
classic Jeremy response.
There's always so much going on, but it's like, you know, when I write the newsletter each week, it's like, how deep do I really want to go? I haven't been sleeping that well. I don't want to kind of get into it. I'm just kind of plumbing through and pretending everything is okay. And
put a smile on your dial,
yes,
Jeremy.
I do have a smile on my dial indeed. So let's move straight into things. Laura, what do you got for us this week?
So this piece was doing the rounds on the Slack team that's run by Boom, headed up by Jeff Amata, who we had on the show last season, maybe two seasons ago now. My God. Anyway, it comes from Artsy. And the title, it's pretty clickbaity and it's provoked some interesting discussion in response. The article, it's called "Study Finds Artists Become Famous Through Their Friends, Not the Originality of Their Work." So
what's the controversy?
Yes. The piece was inspired by a 2012 exhibition at MoMA in New York that was about the birth of abstraction between sort of 1910 to 1925. And in that show, the curators highlighted the way that the artists might have influenced each other, showing works from over 80 artists and their sort of radical departures from the art traditions of that time. And the show opened with this really large diagram depicting the social networks of each of these artists, showing like who knew each other. And there's actually like this kind of cool like interactive version of the diagram online. Mm. And towards the center were the most connected artists like Picasso and Kandinsky. So the curator of the show, Leah Dickerman, she was inspired by a course that she'd taken with Columbia Business School professor Paul Ingram, which is all about how curators can use their professional networks to achieve success. And then Ingram, along with another colleague, he then used MoMA's eventual sort of diagram and their findings to sort of further examine the role that creativity and social networks played for these artists, specifically in relation to the level of fame that they achieved. And they put all of this out into this like 2018 paper. And one of their general findings was that in order to be successful as an artist, making friends may be more important than producing particularly novel or creative art. Now, of course, I'm saying this statement completely out of context. There are many, many things that contribute to an artist's success, and I'm going to refrain from going into all of the specifics around how they actually quantified success and creativity and social networks for this particular study. It's quite interesting, but I recommend heading to the article link from our show notes if you want to dive deep into that side of things. But I did think that the premise of the discussion was interesting for today's show. You know, like, how does an artist's network contribute to their success? How has this changed over time with the advent of social media? Is it about the quantity of people you know, or is it about who those people are? What does this say about the art itself and its quality? There are a few things first that I'll just note quickly that the study claimed in its findings. So firstly, while past studies suggest that there is a link between creativity and fame, this study found that there was no such correlation for these artists. Rather, it was actually the artists with the largest and most diverse networks of sort of contacts that were most likely to be famous, regardless of how creative their art was. And again, I won't go into how they identified certain works as being more creative than others, but you can read about that in the full piece. Specifically, the greatest predictor of fame for an artist was having a network of contacts from various countries. And I guess it's worth noting that the period of time they're looking at here is very different to ours, but perhaps this is still quite relevant. They also emphasize that an important implication of the research is to show that diverse networks matter not only because of what they can do for your creativity, but there are other benefits as well. So the article mentions that given the modern imperative to meet new people and network across industries in order to open oneself up to career opportunities, the findings aren't really that surprising, but they do kind of offer these reminders that we don't become famous or successful in a vacuum, and perhaps we should seek to sort of diversify our social circles. They also looked at one particular case study of Susanna Duchamp and Vanessa Bell. Of course, this is one case, so not by any means a, you know, definitive example, but it's interesting all the same. Both of these artists, they were part of different influential artist groups of the time, but Duchamp's circle was confined very much to the data artists. And in contrast, Bell's social world encompassed like a really broad mix of artists and collectors and patrons in England and beyond. And her more diverse circle correlated with her greater fame in this case. And they argue here that diversity in your networks feeds creativity, and it actually encourages you to create work that resonates with broader markets, therefore opening up more opportunities for fans and fame. Now, there is so much to dig into here, and it's like really important to remember again that this is one study done on a very specific era of a certain type of artist. And so whilst it does like make for really great clickbait, it doesn't necessarily hold true outside of that particular context, and it would be kind of dangerous to generalize here. But that said, I want to open this up a bit more and talk about it in the context of the kind of current art industry. Jeremy, I'm going to start with you. I mean, how much of a role do you feel an artist network plays in their success?
I think it's huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely. And not to kind of fob this off, but I want to, Jess was talking about kind of her own kind of process, like, you know, in terms of also not to kind of toot our own horn too much, but how Jess got involved with Jackie Winter was a very kind of, it was a very socially kind of connected process of how kind of, I guess, different people led to other different people, and kind of that all kind of connected with us. And even talking to kind of Tin and Ed and like about their, how they kind of use their own friends and they use kind of, you know, people kind of in their work as kind of part of their practice as well. I mean, there's no surprises here. Like everyone, like I think like the social network that exists with those people, like they exist to kind of amplify your work and, you know, where and how it's kind of seen and how it travels kind of through those people. And those are kind of the markers of how this work kind of goes.
Yeah. Let's go on from that then. So Jess, I mean, like for you personally, how much of a role do you think your network has played in your successes?
I think I only came onto Jeremy's radar as an artist because of like unexpected network connections. Like, so I was working in advertising and I was doing personal work, and then someone who followed me on Instagram said, hey, I think this agency is ripping off your work. So that's how I knew about that. And then I told the people at work at my agency about it, and they said it was an art buyer or something. And they said, oh, we know Jeremy. Maybe Jeremy can help you. And then like, so it was this whole like kind of 6 degrees thing. And that was like way back in 2013. So even for that, I think my network's been extremely important. And I think also, so my ad agency background has been my network that's kind of helped me become, you know, successful, I guess. Like when I was, you know, my last job was in an ad agency. So when I left that agency, I had contacts in that industry. I knew art buyers, I knew print producers, and I knew art directors. And advertising has a really short turnover of staff. So everyone moves to different agencies and then they, you know, pitch my work at that agency. And then more people find out about that. And then, so yeah, it was kind of just a really natural network and not one that I actively tried to like nurture. It just, I happened to be working in an industry that then became my clients.
Well, that's something I wanted to ask, I guess, whether now it's something that you are sort of conscious of in terms of diversifying your social circles, like they talk about here, and how that potentially impacts the growth of your career.
Like, I don't go, I'm going to go and network today. Like, I'm not, you know, trying to
put on my networking hat.
Yeah. But I think I just kind of like, I just like talking to people in the industry. So like, if I find an artist's work, an art director's work, and I like it, I'll tell them that. And then sometimes that does lead to, you know, a further relationship or whatever. Yeah, I think I also think because I do quite a broad variety of work, so my work is getting in all sorts of different little markets. So I think just naturally what I do leads to kind of me having a bigger network than, say, someone who does something really specific.
Yes, that's true. Well, because one thing I was wondering about this study is like, whether there's a hole in kind of correlation versus causation, which is always something I pick on whenever we bring articles here. But I'm wondering, you know, like, did these people become popular because of their networks, or did they get broader networks because they were popular with a sort of select few? Who knows? I guess it's sort of they feed into each other. But yeah, someone made a really interesting point on the Boom Slack where I initially saw this piece, and I think it's really valid. They sort of pointed out that, you know, the benefit of having connections isn't just getting your foot in the door. It's having experienced and knowledgeable people at your fingertips who can advise you on decision-making in your career. So it's not just about having connections. Like, it's more about the value in their capacity as kind of free career coaches, which I think is a really fantastic point. But the same person also said the following, which I thought was interesting. And the only reason I'm not saying their name is because I don't know if they want to be identified, but they said, I think it definitely helps to be well-connected, but being connected isn't everything. I'm actually in a kind of embarrassing situation of being pretty well-connected and still not breaking through in the way that I'd like. So good work has to be there to make a career. If you do good work and the connections are there, it's like a bit of extra fuel in your tank, but connections don't get you anywhere automatically.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have to also draw the line between kind of connections and community and kind of what that kind of means now. Mm. Because I think, and this is where I think there's probably the biggest divide between the fine art world and the commercial art world. Because I think, I mean, for all the pitfalls of the fine art world, I do feel it's much more kind of communal. Like, whereas I think in the illustration world, especially, is so much more kind of cutthroat. Like, especially, I don't know, like every time, I think the kind of competition is just so much higher because you're relying on commissioners, you know? So it's like, usually it's kind of like the marketplace is just kind of set up a bit differently, where I think often there's a lot of people kind of competing for the same job and kind of the same real estate. And so I think there's always like a bit of kind of tension there, where I kind of think in, you know, in fine art, it's much more about kind of going outwards, you know, and kind of finding people kind of that way.
I agree on some level, but I also disagree in that, like, I think that at least in terms of like the returns you get, what you get paid for the what you're doing and how you're sort of celebrated for it, I think in commercial illustration or commercial art, that is far more based on skill. Whereas in fine art, that has a lot to do with names and connections. More, not necessarily more so, but as equally as much as how talented you are.
Well, I think that's, I mean, yeah, because
that's... Whereas in commercial art, if you have a style that the art director wants, I don't really care who you are or, you know, like, I don't know. That's how I see it.
No, I mean, it's really interesting. I kind of feel that the names, though, is kind of where, yeah, that's kind of where a lot of kind of value kind of comes from. It's like, no one's work is kind of really valuable in fine art until somebody buys it.
Yeah.
You know, and they put the value on it, and that person's name.
Whereas that's not the same in commercial art, though.
Well, it's on a completely kind of different scale, but it's more kind of like, well, where are your commissions? But like, that's, you know, and that could be kind of something that gives you kind of more, gives you more kind of relevancy in that regard. But I don't think, I think that's kind of much more kind of divorced from the kind of personal network that you're in that kind of way.
Yeah, perhaps. I just feels like more of a meritocracy to me, but maybe I'm just too,
I don't know. I mean,
biased because I do this stuff.
Jess, you're pretty active on our kind of Corvid community as well as kind of our own group. I mean, how do you see things? Do you think there's a different way that you kind of communicate with people or develop your community kind of with people? If you're talking to someone kind of on the Jackie Winter roster, for example, when you're talking to kind of another illustrator that's kind of working out there, like, you know, what do those things kind of come across deliberately or are they just kind of unintentional?
I'm not sure if there's a difference between, you know, how I communicate with the two groups. I mean, I think like one thing I do is that if someone sends me a brief and I don't want to do it or, you know, I'm not available, I'll send them at least 4 or 5 different artists that would be able to work on that brief, whether they're in the Jackie Winter roster or not. So I'm kind of like, I guess I like to be helpful. So I try not to see people as competition Or maybe I try to see them more as like healthy competition. Like, you know, it's good for me to have that competition to keep pushing what I do, I guess. I know that when I was starting out that I would have loved some help or connections or whatever. So I kind of do try to be a little bit more helpful now that I maybe I'm in a position to offer it.
Absolutely.
Are there any kind of, are there any things that you can identify where kind of people are doing the same for you when you were kind of coming up?
Yeah, I had a couple. I don't know that anything actually ended, you know, resulted in me landing any projects or whatever, but I did remember it being quite nice to, if someone I admired then like referred a job down to me. It was just like that little confidence boost that is important when you're starting out. Yeah, so I guess I'm always really surprised when I see someone on Instagram whose work I think is of really high quality, but they don't have many followers. So it's like someone who doesn't seem to have as much of a network as they should.
Although as an agent for me, that's like, oh my God, I want them. I want to, you know, that's when I want to jump in and really be part of their career.
But it's, I guess it's also kind of like, you know, before Instagram was so important to all of us finding success, like there were just people who did really good work and were known to the people who were commissioning them and sort of no one else, and they were successful. Like, I think the importance of network depends on your definition of success.
Yeah, I agree.
And look, yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting kind of takeaways here. I kind of think, you know, there's, Laura, you mentioned kind of towards the end of the piece, they look at a case example and kind of make the point that we won't become famous in a vacuum and should seek to diversify our social circles. And I think that's a really interesting point because now the circles are so much kind of tighter, whereas, you know, you look at these kind of these larger art movements and there were not that many kind of people working in there. So I think, you know, you really kind of needed that. Now everything is about kind of finding your network as well. So I think there's a tendency to kind of withdraw and kind of work more in a vacuum because I think that's where the kind of best work is kind of coming as well. But something that I always kind of talk about, you know, here in the podcast, especially for freelancers of any stripe, is that kind of 100 true fans. Like, you know, how do you get those kind of 100 people? And I think it's really about, I don't know, like if it's not kind of like, it's more about becoming famous, not through your friends, but I guess like through your network and kind of through your patrons and kind of through your followers. And I think that's where kind of things are kind of going more in the direction to. And I think, yeah, whatever the new platform, you know, speaking about Instagram the other week, whatever the new kind of platform that I guess takes over for Instagram will be, you know, the thing that kind of leads it in that way. So yeah, really interesting stuff. Thank you for bringing it to the table, Laura.
No worries.
We'll move on from there. My link from the week comes courtesy from Bianca from our own professional development Slack, titled Welcome to the Bold and Blocky Instagram Era of Book Covers. This is a piece on Vulture, and even though it's a bit of an older link from late January, it's been sitting in my open tabs forever, and I thought having Jess on the show would make for some good conversation, especially considering the niche that she's carved out for YA book covers, both here in Australia, but even more so in the States. So look, the piece written by Margot Boyer-Dry examines the emerging or current trend of book covers in the age of Instagram. And she writes, I quote, at a time when half of all book purchases in the US are made on Amazon and many of those on mobile, the first job of the book cover after gesturing at the content inside is to look great in miniature. That means where fine details once thrived, splashy prints have taken over grounding text that's sturdy enough to be deciphered on screen, ranging from medium to minuscule. She then goes on to kind of chart the semi-recent history of modern book design. So you have the more traditional design systems that kind of Penguin rolled out in the 50s, you know, they're kind of locking up this kind of type and, you know, these graphic elements, to the advent of photography in the 60s, to smaller and more intimate type in the 90s, taking into account the more kind of close-up relationship people had with books and shops, to the current day where everything has to work as a thumbnail image. All this is coming at the same time, but there's heaps of pressure in the publishing market. Sales are actually increasing, or have increased by 11%, but the industry has actually lost $1 billion in revenue because Amazon basically just undercuts all prices, and therefore it's resulting in a much lower risk from that people are willing to take from a design perspective. Like any marketing activity, book covers are there to sell books, and there's heaps of algorithms and research that still lie at the heart of larger publishers. But with Instagram, that's all really starting to change. And I quote another part from the article, and she says, the more touch points a potential reader has with a particular book, the more times they see a cover posted by an account they trust, the more likely they are to buy. Consider a fairly recent Instagram success, Alex Chee's How to Write an Autobiographical Novel. It's a book that people posted pictures of so many times that the word of mouth became word of eye, says Straub. Not only would someone come in and say, I've heard about this book, but they'd know what it looked like. This, Margot states, has led to what she calls a second wave of internet-forward book design. So where books need to work well both on the internet as well as in real life, where bookstores are actually having a major resurgence as the Amazon backlash kind of continues. And that's where we're at today with kind of design, again, quoting, breaking the plane of text in ways that can only be appreciated through physical contact. So while print finishing has always been a realm of exploration and fun with designers, spot varnishes, special finishes, deckled edges on stock, foil, special foldings, etc., the idea of leaning into the book as an object is really not anything new. McSweeney's, for example, probably pushed the boundaries more than any other publisher in regards to what a book could be. They had a box set of books. They had an unbundled newspapers. They were really pushing that so far, and those made them amazing objects that you coveted and wanted to have. It was a pretty genius business model in addition to having amazing writing. But in some ways, I think they were a bit early in terms of how this all works with the internet today. And I think in many ways, the book has always been a lifestyle object, especially if you're reading in public. I've actually seen many times living in New York, or when I did live in New York, these little kind of slipcases that people put over books when reading on the subway.
Remember when 50 Shades of Grey came out and everyone was like, hide?
I don't remember that. No.
Don't pretend like you didn't do that.
But that's exactly what you say, because the book you read, it says things about you. So it's no surprise that publishers are leaning into this a bit more, considering how this works in a social media setting, trying to further leverage marketing in a very complex and challenging market. Similar to how chefs cook food meant to be photographs, I'm curious what this means for designers and illustrators. So look, Laura, I want to kind of turn to you first as a voracious reader. What's your opinion here on
my job title?
Yes. What is your opinion on the book or book cover as a lifestyle signifier? Like, do covers play a role in the books that you choose to read or seek out at all?
I mean, look, I will say that I do, of course, look pretty often at the list of kind of notable book designs and designers that come out every once in a while, because I appreciate that on its own as a separate thing, as an art form. I mean, I love looking at book covers, and also because it's a part of my job to know what's happening in that realm. But on a personal level, no, I don't think it really does influence what I read. I think it's funny reading. I love this article. This one has also been saved in my pocket for like months. It's a great piece. But I think cover art actually used to play a far larger role for me in terms of dictating what I read than it does now. I think, back in the old days, unless it was a gift, every book I read came from going to a bookshop for an hour or two and flicking through whatever caught my eye. And when you're presented with shelves and shelves and shelves of books, it's really kind of only the covers, the titles, and the staff suggestion notes, the little post-its that lead you to one book over another. So the designs played a huge role, of course. And I guess even then, though, despite the work that I do, I'm definitely far more verbal than visual. And I'll usually notice the title and the subheading of a book before I realize what's even around it. That's just the way my brain works. But these days, almost everything I read comes from recommendations, from friends, from articles, from interviews with people. In fact, my housemate works at a really great little independent bookstore, and she has to read like everything that comes in, pretty much. So I basically just get this like constant stream of books from her. And a nice cover is a wonderful bonus, but it impacts very little in what I choose. That said, I guess I am getting these from recommendations. So who's to say what's influencing the people who are recommending them to me? It could be, very well be the book covers. But honestly, I can't think of a book that I've been put off from reading because of the cover alone. Also, it's only quite recently, really, since like living with this housemate, that I've actually started reading things that were published in the last few years, like things that would actually have these sort of trendy new cover designs. Like I've been keeping a list for the last like 5-10 years of things that I want to get around to reading one day, and I'm just still making my way through that list. And a lot of what I read is kind of a decade or two or 4 or 6 decades old, so it's not like that relevant to this discussion. There's only one example that I can think of, though, in recent times where I did choose a book specifically because of its cover. Well, like I chose to read the blurb because of its cover and consequently decided I needed to read it. And that was Insomniac City by Bill Hayes. Bendra, if you're listening, I know you love that book. the cover is just absolutely stunning. But it was the fact that the blurb, then told me that it was a sad, beautiful love story to New York and to my favorite writer and human of all time, Oliver Sacks. That's what really sold it to me. Without that, I would have probably appreciated the cover, but popped it back down. Anyway, all I'm saying is that perhaps a cover might help me notice something, but unless the blurb and the opening paragraphs are quality as well, there's just like no chance that I'm reading it. And I say knowing all of this, knowing that like it's a very personal thing, and again, research sample of one. And I do agree with the article absolutely that this is a distinct trend for very clear reasons. I wanted to read a bit as well from the piece in the author's words, Margot Boyer-Dry. If books have design errors, we're in an age of statement wallpaper and fatty text. We have the internet to thank, and not just the interface, but the economy that's evolved around it. From the leather-bound volumes of old to lurid mass-market paperbacks, book covers were never designed in a vacuum. Their presentation had everything to do with the way books were made, where and how, and to whom they were sold. And when you look at book covers right now, what you'll see blaring back at you, bold and dazzling, is a highly competitive marketing landscape dominated by online retail, social media, and their curiously symbiotic rival, the resurgent independent bookstore. But yeah, highly recommend the article. It's a great read and some very clever insight onto the history and development of book design.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of other things to consider here also kind of geographically in terms of, you know, what, how covers also change, like kind of for the region that we're in. I've always found Australia is really interesting because sometimes we get American covers, sometimes we get the UK covers, yeah, and sometimes we get kind of our own cover. But I think that as an audience or as readers become more design literate, there's also kind of these subconscious cues that you get. Like there are kind of famous book cover designers like Jonathan Gray, for example. And it's like, and I think, you know, or like if you're looking to kind of see, or like Chip Kidd, for example, like if you see that they've commissioned a hotshot book designer, or if you see that a publisher has invested in doing all these kind of special effects and kind of really investing it, then that, I think that also kind of sends a cue that like, okay, maybe this book is good, or like why,
yes,
otherwise,
I
why
wrote
it
the same thing
it?
As well. Exactly. I think the better the script, you know, the better, the more money they invest in a title. And that sometimes works the other way, where like the less money they're investing something, kind of sometimes the more creative freedom we get when we're doing a book project, I find.
Well, Jess, I want to turn to you about this. I mean, maybe you can give us a bit of behind the scenes magic of what kind of goes down in this process. So how do you kind of consider all this when designing a cover? I mean, is this part of the direct conversation that you have with the art director or with the client? Because I mean, this is your kind of niche now. So yeah, take us a bit more through what goes on.
Surprisingly, the issue of like thumbnail ability hasn't come up as much as I think it should have in the work that I've done. I'm not sure if it's because, like, I do a lot of work in young adult children's kind of market, so I'm not sure if that has any kind of impact on that, but I've been asked twice, I think, or it's been mentioned twice out of all the projects I've done. One was for, I was doing a cover for a book of poetry by someone who's like an Insta poet, like someone who's very famous on Instagram. So that one of the first points back was, oh, this particular content will be great on Amazon. And the other one only happened like last month, but something I'm actually currently working on. And the art director said, oh, this one will work great as a thumbnail. But that's the only time that it's ever actually been brought up. Like I did a book last year and it was for a young adult reinterpretation of the Joan of Arc story. And they wanted detail and they wanted black letter and metallic, you know, metallic ink and then like fluoro on top. Like they really weren't concerned at all, I don't think, about how it would look online, which I thought was very interesting. And I kind of wish that people would think a little more about how a book is going to look online. Like I wish they'd say, you know, this cover could be animated as a GIF. Like, you know, can you think about those elements while you're designing it? Because I think in my experience, it's still kind of like make a beautiful print book first and then make sure it looks like okay online. So yeah, my experience has kind of been almost the opposite of the article. But having said that, I am someone who does a lot of hand lettering. I'm less doing these kind of big blocky titles. So maybe it's just kind of like the art directors are coming to me already knowing what they want. So yeah, it's really interesting to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that it was really interesting, the points raised in the article about how the current pressures on the publishing industry have led sort of publishers to making safer choices and taking fewer risks and opting for designs that they know will work already. And I think like, in some ways, I think I do see this reflected as a consumer. In some ways, I don't. I think there's actually been a really incredible diversity in book covers over the last few years. So I don't know how true this is, but
I don't know. It's kind of, it feels almost kind of like, you know, The Social Network, like when the movie came out with that iconic, you know, poster of like the head and then the three mm-hmm. lines of type. Like, don't you feel that? I mean, something similar is like whenever I look at these kind of, I'm Googling now kind of like all these kind of best of, you know, lists from last year, and like they all look kind
of. But the ones that make the best of lists are also like the same designers who choose the samey things for that list. But if you go into an actual bookstore and look around, there's quite a bit of diversity, or at least I think.
Well, it depends where you're looking at it. I mean, look, I think in some ways this trend is like it's kind of like tech illustration in some ways as well, where like, you know, a lot of like, you know, yes, there are kind of differences, but there is kind of, people are trying to achieve kind of the same goal. So with tech, it's all about kind of, or with, you know, web products, like, okay, humanizing the product. And with this, it's all about kind of, yeah, standing out on the shelf. So, I mean, yeah, in this regard, I mean, we're going to be talking a lot more about tech illustration in the coming weeks, but have either of you noticed any kind of emerging styles that are bucking this trend, or, you know, where this could kind of go to next for a third wave?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's bucking the trend in any way, but I am very much digging the beautiful kind of blending of photography and illustration and lettering that we're seeing more of these days. Like, it's just seems like a nice culmination of all the trends we've seen in book design over the years, kind of now finding a happy harmony together. But I guess on that note, like, there was a cover recently for a beautiful book that I've now forgotten the name of, that was an essay about postpartum depression, and Alison Colpoys did the cover, the original cover here in Australia, and then it was redone for the US edition, and the wonderful designer Na Kim redid the cover. And it was actually, she basically took kind of what Al had done and rejigged it a bit, which was, that was the brief. That was what was meant to be done. But I remember getting a bit frustrated because Na Kim is an incredible designer, really, really talented, and then won a bunch of awards for that particular piece though. And really the only differences was that it had been made kind of more Instagram friendly, like a little bit more trendy, which, and I don't know, I just found that hard, being that like, there was sort of one artist who'd done the original kind of look, which might have been a bit more traditional. And then it was taken into this new era with some very slight adjustments, and all of it was like attributed to someone else. But it is interesting how like that cover gained so much traction after like a few sort of changes. But I guess, yeah, touching on tech though, like, I think one thing that was really interesting in this piece that I hadn't sort of considered so much was that, you know, how publishers actually sort of now have, because they don't sell directly to consumers, rather they're kind of funneling sales through Amazon and Barnes and Noble, independent bookstores, whatever, they're unable to gather like much data on purchasing patterns, and how in turn, like, left with these kind of blunt tools and fuzzy math, publishers resort to instinct and look for ways to produce the kind of most visible proof of concept, which is publicity, right? And, you know, where do we go for publicity in this age of tech? And that's social media. And ergo, we get this kind of social media friendly design trend. And the writer sort of talks as well about that bizarre marriage of irony and logic that we have today, with both Instagram and bookstores playing a really key role in the buying of books. Because what many people don't realize is that in the wake of kind of the decline of Barnes and Nobles and Borders years ago, you know, as a certain type of consumer, myself totally included, has grown to kind of fetishize the local and the real life, indie bookshops have really enjoyed quite a surprising resurgence. Like, their existence in the US, they quoted these numbers in the piece, increased by 35% between 2009 and 2015, which I think a lot of people don't realize. Many people think it's the opposite. And within their communities, both in person and online, these independent stores provide kind of a similar thing to the visually driven social media. As the article says, inevitable customers are as likely to photograph the shelves as they are to read what's on them. So we find ourselves in the recursive modern world of bookselling, tumbling through an endless loop from the physical to digital and back again. Confusing as that loop may be, it's an apt summation of this moment in design. And I just thought that was a really, really lovely point. And then, like, carrying on from that, Helen Yentis, who's the art director at Riverhead Publishing, responsible for most of their covers, she's quoted in the piece saying that today's cover art needs to be ambidextrous, that covers need to work equally well in both settings of online and IRL. She says, if you miss the details, you're still getting an interesting, captivating visual. But if you're giving it a closer look, the details are there. And I think that's where that kind of second wave of internet forward book design comes in that you mentioned earlier, Jeremy, as we kind of like double down on elements that shine on screen but can also be really fully appreciated through physical contact. And it seems like this is a really recurring theme in like the things that are fueling so much of our conversation on this show these days. I think like that convergence of our physical and digital worlds, and how creatives and industries across the spectrum are reckoning with that and adjusting their outputs to respond to that. Mm. And I feel like that comes up all the time, whether we're talking about VR or retail or internet safety or whatever it might be. That seems to be like a really, really recurring theme that's driving so much of what's happening around us at the moment.
Amazing. Jess, any closing thoughts on this?
I found something that I thought was quite fun on Reddit, because there's like a book subreddit and people were talking about book cover cliches. So this one person said, I hate modern book covers. Everything is minimalist. Give me something busy like the good old days when I'd finished a chapter and looked to see if the plot that was just revealed was hinted at by the cover art. And I thought that was like, because I do try, if I get a manuscript, I do try and work some tiny little detail into the cover art just for someone to find.
I really appreciate that as well when people do that.
Yes, I really like that little quote.
Lovely.
Any Easter eggs that we should kind of look out for in upcoming work at all?
Ooh, Not that I can talk about.
We'll talk after the show.
Fair enough. Thanks very much for your feedback there, and we'll move on to our last link from there. As is our custom every week, the last link of the show goes out to our guests. Just before we get stuck into what you brought to us, give us a bit more details on your internet hygiene. Where do you kind of get your links from? Where do you get your readings? Yeah, I want to hear all about it.
Well, this particular link is from one of the few newsletters I subscribe to, apart from the Jackie Winter ones, of course.
Good shout out.
So this designer, Daniel Gray, who's a book cover designer who I really admire, he sends out a little newsletter every couple of weeks that's just got, you know, a handful of good quality links. And I always, like, you know how at the bottom of the newsletter there's sometimes like a buy me a coffee if you like this link, if you like this newsletter. Well, I always, like, a couple of times I've bought him a coffee because he just posts really interesting stuff.
I want to point out, it's not the Daniel Gray that we represent as an illustrator, different Daniel Gray.
But with the same initials as well.
Yes. Oh, crazy. Jess, do you want to just tell us a bit more about what the link is, what it says, etc.?
Yeah, so this link is called When Your Work Is Also Your Hobby. And it's just a little blog post by this book cover designer. And he's talking about his friend saying, the worst thing about my job being my hobby is that I don't have a hobby. So it's basically kind of about work-life balance and whether this applies when you are doing what you love for work. And this is something that I've been thinking about like a lot lately. So when this email landed in my inbox, I was like, oh my God. And then I bought him a coffee. Yeah. So I guess I've been thinking about this because I've realized that I don't really have work-life balance as someone who draws for a hobby and draws for a living. And I'm not sure if this is like an okay thing or if I should just not care about it. Because, like, for example, I spent the whole weekend working on a really ornate book cover. And then when I finished it on Sunday night, I went, yay, I can draw something else now. And I went and drew something else. And it was just kind of like, and then that drawing that I did will then go into my folio, and I'm probably going to get some other work based on that work, you know, 6 months down the line. So every single thing that I do kind of is related to my work. Like, you know, I love books. I love reading, and I'm also now a book cover designer. So even if I go into a bookshop, I'm automatically sort of looking at the shelves going, okay, like, what's the latest design trend here? You know, like, it's never just, I want to find a book. It's kind of like a research excursion. Yeah, so I was wondering, especially you, Jeremy, because you do so much, do you guys have hobbies that are completely unrelated to what you do for work?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think my biggest hobby is probably ice hockey.
He says as he wears his his ice hockey shirt right now.
But I think, yeah, like, it's still kind of related in kind of some ways. Like, I kind of think, you know, there's...
How?
Well, because it helps me function better at work. Like, you know, it helps me. It's like...
And that's the reason you do it?
Well, in some, like, no, look, there's definitely a part of it that I kind of intrinsically kind of love, but I kind of think, especially when you, as one thing I have kind of noticed that is one of the hardest parts, like, for me kind of getting older or kind of running the business, is that the things that I do just because I like them have kind of faded away, maybe in kind of the nature of kind of efficiency, where, like, I need to have like a real kind of good reason to kind of do it. And look, I don't kind of pretend that to be a very kind of positive or kind of healthy thing, but it's kind of the way that I do it.
You know what made you real good at work, Jeremy? When you broke your collarbone and couldn't come into work for like 6 weeks from playing ice hockey?
You know, I think sometimes, yeah, like, sometimes those kind of things force you, like, you know, you need to kind of take breaks as well. So
why I did that.
I wouldn't deny that. You can't deny sometimes things happen kind of subconsciously, yeah. You know, in that kind of way.
Also, I pushed you because I wanted to host Creative Mornings. Yeah.
Yes, I thought that shadowy figure with the baseball bat in the parking lot looked eerily familiar. But yeah, you know, for me, like, you know, a lot, I think, yeah, the reason people start their own businesses, and we talked about this, you know, when we were talking about the value-based pricing model and the whole time is money thing, it's like, yeah, you want that kind of freedom and you want to be able to kind of pursue what you kind of enjoy. So look, I mean, as cliche as it is, I think, to say, you know, the work I do doesn't really kind of feel like work. I mean, it does when I have to manage Lara every day. When it gets really tough.
Yeah, you had to dig back eventually, I guess.
But I try to figure out a way to kind of make it kind of all work together kind of holistically in a way. And that doesn't go for my own hobbies, but the other things that we kind of do as a business, and make sure that it kind of feeds back in kind of in that way where everyone kind of is benefiting. Because, yeah, it's a real weird kind of work that we do in that way.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely enjoyed reading this piece, even if I don't necessarily agree with all of it to the T. I think it was a really fun read. There's very witty lines, and I'm really keen to read more of his writing. So, Jess, thank you for introducing me to him.
Great folio, by the way. I love his site.
Yeah. I would say, yeah, I definitely have hobbies, quite a few of them. Exercising, cooking, playing guitar, whatever, reading about prison reform, you know, standard stuff. But, you know, I guess, in fact, I would say that, like, actually, like, 99% of my hobbies are nothing at all to do with my work, because I guess precisely because I spend so much time with my head completely engulfed in my work. And I do consider myself one of the lucky ones who loves what I do, despite working with Jeremy. But I disagree with Daniel here in that I think, for me personally at least, it's absolutely imperative that I get out of the headspace of commercial art every once in a while, or I will get sick of it. And I like liking what I do, you know? I think the problem for me isn't that I don't have hobbies, it's that I don't have much time for my hobbies. So, you know, unlike Daniel, although I love what I do, I still have a desire definitely to enjoy different things in life as well. So yeah, I think work-life balance is a definite goal for me. And I don't know, I always think it's a bit weird that it's not for him, but maybe I'm just like seeing things from a totally different perspective. Who knows?
Well, I'm curious, Laura, can you tell us a bit more? Because like most of the people that I associate with are other kind of business owners. And this is something that comes up kind of all the time.
Yeah, rich person parties.
Yes. Where we hunt the most dangerous game.
Exactly.
Humans. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Laura, you have a lot of other friends who are kind of producers and artists as well. Like, you know, what kind of feedback do you kind of hear on this? Or what do you see that kind of socially, how other people kind of handle it?
I think this ties back into like a lot of the discussions we've had recently about, I mean, work-life balance has come up. Also, we were talking recently about seeing your time as money and how like the potential sort of dangers in that. And I think that happens a lot for people who are probably earlier on in their careers, where you feel guilty if you're not working. And I don't know, I think that can be a really dangerous headspace. And I see a lot of people battling with that. And I think there is something really important about coming to terms with some sort of line between work and life. I know that it's fluid and it moves, but I think when they are really one and the same all the time, that can actually be quite unhealthy, particularly when you are really kind of bootstrapping it. I don't know, like I for example, there was a line I really enjoyed in the piece. He says, you know, working my hobbying my work isn't really a problem, not a problem. I don't take my cozy little life for granted. And I realize that being able to do what I love for a living is hardly a hardship. Few will weep over 12 years a designer.
I love that line.
I know, it's so good. It may be exhausting and frustrating at times, but being able to devote your life to a creative vocation is pretty fantastic. And like, yeah, I think, you know, doing something you love, doing something creative is absolutely, without a doubt, a privilege. But doing what I love for a living has also forced me to expand my hobbies. And I am genuinely grateful for that. Like, there was one line in particular in this piece that, like, whilst it was absolutely delightfully written, I felt it was like kind of worth contradicting. So Daniel wrote, "Whether you enjoy it or not, your work is part of your life, not its antithesis. Pitching one against the other in a nonsensical conflict, this way of thinking only fosters widespread contempt for gainful employment. What good is this unhelpful idea that when you're at work, you aren't alive?" And I think there's like some value in this argument, but I also don't think there's a reason to snub work-life balance altogether. Like, I think he's making the mistake of kind of bundling together the need for downtime with the need to enjoy what you do for a living. Like, needing space from work doesn't mean you hate what you do or that you're only alive when you're not working. I think part of loving your work is giving yourself some space from it every now and then, same as you would with like your husband or wife or children. I imagine you're a better father because of some of the time that you have away from your kids, right, Jeremy?
I mean, that's a real kind of tricky question that I'm kind of grappling with in a bunch of different ways, because also sometimes, you know, having kids puts more pressure on, you know, to work more or work harder or kind of get, you know, better.
I just mean that I think you're better at doing, it's exactly what you're saying, like how ice hockey helps you be better at work because it's time away and doing something else and getting your headspace into a different sort of frame. And that means when you return to your work, you are better at doing that thing. But again, as we spoke about another show, like I kind of hate the idea that the only reason you should do anything other than work is to make you better at your work when you get back to work. You know, I think that's kind of like, I don't know. Doing things for the pure sake of enjoyment is something that I absolutely love and have no problem doing. But yeah, I mean, maybe that space isn't even something that's like separate thematically from what you do. Like, perhaps you are a designer who in their downtime loves to read historical design texts, and that's completely fine. But I still believe there's a distinction between always being on the clock and working for a client to make money versus doing something for pure enjoyment, regardless of whether it generates something useful for you in your working life or not down the track.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, having that separation is so is so vital. And I think that's what a lot of big tech companies are kind of trying to work against in terms of, yes, setting up the workplace as your kind of life, that you can have all your kind of needs met there. And if you don't, you know, that you are kind of a pariah, you're not going to kind of fit into the kind of that culture.
So, well, like, there was one bit that kind of like almost freaked me out. Like, I mean, yeah, look, I have to say, I think it's great that he doesn't feel the desire to have anything else sort of necessarily going on other than his sort of passion for design. And that's awesome that that sustains him. But to dismiss the idea as a whole that people who aren't in his camp aren't doing something they love is a bit excessive. And he wrote at one point, "Do I have any hobbies? Some that are completely separate from my job. Do I have an off switch? Great big no. Having spent years kneading bits of my life into an enjoyable career-shaped lump, it's now a case of all design all the time. I don't stop absorbing, sketching, fretting. I spend my time plucking ideas from my head and putting them on the back burner, rejigging personal projects or pinning found loveliness onto boards, things that will one day fit. I read design, I write design, I shop design," which like legitimately could be satire about this kind of whole thing of like worshiping at the altar of work that we often talk about. And I just, it seems like a big red flag screaming like burnout, burnout is just like on its way. I'm worried about what will happen to him if he keeps doing this in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
Well, this thing is from 2014. So it's,
we can ask him.
We can actually check in and kind of see.
But like, I have a hunch that he's counting hobbies only as the kind of cliche things, horse riding, building model planes, gardening, etc. But hobbies and work-life balance can come in much simpler forms. Like it can be the walk you take every Saturday morning or the time that you spend yourself making the perfect coffee each day or talking to your kids about their day at school. All of those things are part of work-life balance. And the idea that he is all work all the time is probably a bit false. Like I think he's rejecting something on paper that he's probably actually executing in real life.
Interesting.
That's just my two cents. No.
Jess, what about you? I mean, personally, what do you try to do to kind of switch off from work? Or,
well, I have a dog, so that's a dog kind of a hobby. But I spend about 2 hours a day walking the dog, which is great because that is one of the few things that I found that I can switch off. Like I'll just go let him loose in the off-leash path and just watch him just play with all the other dogs, and it's very delightful. I also
get that from having a dog as well. It's the best.
It's like really what I needed. I'm not sure what I did before I had a dog. I also go running, which kind of gives me that sort of an hour or so out from my day where I'm just thinking about like trying to better my personal best or whatever.
You can run for an hour?
No, part of it's like walking.
Yeah, cool. But makes me feel better.
I wish I could run for an hour. But I am really switched on a lot of the time. Like I don't always enjoy it. Like I don't want to not have a work-life balance. Like I don't like waking up at 2 a.m. thinking about spine layouts or like lettering, you know, but it happens. And I was talking to my husband about this and he kind of went, well, maybe if you weren't thinking about lettering at 2 a.m. you'd be up thinking about something else at 2 a.m. so, you know, maybe it's not such an issue. And I will say one thing. So I have an obsessive personality, so I do have clinically diagnosed OCD. It makes it really hard to switch off. Like I just keep thinking and thinking and thinking about stuff. And I wonder like how many other, you know, creatives who are in my situation maybe also have that problem and they don't kind of realize.
Yeah, completely. I completely agree with you. And that's a really valid point. And it's, I get the same, you know, the kind of, you're thinking about stuff constantly. And with the kind of work that we do, being in the sort of, particularly, I look at production, you know, being in the service industry and needing to be almost constantly available to our artists and to our clients, it's really damn hard to switch off from, especially just from like a lack of time perspective. Like I am notorious for working far later than I ever should on a way too frequent basis. But I don't know. I still think that like, usually once I've knocked out the things that I need to do and I have time to switch off, I normally have not too much of a problem doing so because I'm so ready to by that point. And I do love switching off from work. For me, it's really a matter of managing my time. So one thing I do try to do is like I really try to actively like block a few things into my schedule each week that will force me to make time for them. Like maybe it's a dinner reservation or like a trip away on the weekend, or it's like movie tickets or something, things that can't or like really shouldn't be moved. And if I block that time out in my schedule, then I make sure that I work around it. Like I just do it. I make it work. I treat it like a meeting with a client, because you know what it's like. Like you have a work meeting blocked in, you don't you don't cancel it so you can work on other stuff instead. You just make the time somehow. But with personal stuff, it's so much harder to do that. And if my time is more fluid and open, then I do have a tendency to just work and work and work and work and work. So scheduling stuff in and treating it like a non-negotiable is how I kind of make sure I switch off when I need to.
Well, look, lots of really great feedback here. And yeah, again, great newsletter, great blog. Thanks for bringing it to the table, Jess. And yeah, we'll chat about this more, put in all of it in our show notes, and we'll wrap up from there. Before we go, though, it is time for our favorite segment, Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, Shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the blad, the blad.
The blad.
The blad. The brad. The good, the brad.
I'm going to get the brad out.
The good, the bad, Brad's and the brad good. Off of our chest. Jess, get us started. Anything you would like to endorse, complain about, or just kind of chat about in this kind of open space?
I have a little thumbs down. It's actually quite funny. So I went to buy a chocolate the other day and it's in little segments, one of those Kinder Bueno things. And I was like so excited about it that I started eating it on the way home. And I was standing at the stoplights, and then one of the segments fell off and like onto the ground. And then people saw me, like I sat there, I stood there, and you would have been able to see me go, I'm not sure what I should do. Should I pick it up? Or should I leave it there? And then I decided, well, if a dog gets it, that's not great. So I picked up the chocolate. But then as I did that, a little piece of the wrapper floated away and I had to run after that. And it was just one of those, like, you know, watching a kid drop his ice cream. It was very sad, but I hope someone, on the thumbs up side, I hope someone saw that and it, like, made their day.
I want to know, did you eat the bit?
No, I did not.
Oh, I definitely would have.
5 second rule. Laura, what do you got?
I have a thumbs down to trying. I have a thumbs down to baking your own bread. I thought I'd get in on the trend this weekend, and I was like, but I don't have like starter or anything. I'm like not one of those people. So I just tried to like make a basic like baguette, and it took fucking hours. And like kneading is really hard work, especially because I'm short and my bench is high. So I have to be like on my tippy toes to get enough like height over it. And then, you know, after all this time, it came out. It like tasted like bread. I don't know. It was like kind of mediocre. It tasted like cheap bread. And it's been like a day and a half and it's already rock hard and like completely inevitable. And I have good bakeries near me. And like what? It would have been cheaper and easier to just go and buy actually nice bread. Don't make bread. There's lots of bakeries.
I'm going to send you a link to a really easy bread that is delicious.
People say this. People keep telling me this. But also send me the link. I'm going to try again.
Have you seen the one in the New York Times?
That's the one I made. If it's that one.
Not a baguette, though.
Okay.
It's like a donate bed.
We'll stick it in the show notes.
We'll put it in the show notes. Jeremy, what about you?
Look, I don't know where to put this. I mean, it's got so many, it's giving me so many confusing emotions.
Layered.
Tamari almonds. It's like...
Thumbs up.
So, like, okay, like, they are, like...
Actual crack.
Actual crack.
Yeah.
Not to kind of, yeah, like, you know, yes, it's actual crack. I mean, almonds are generally not great to have in large quantities. They are very calorically dense.
But it's also physically impossible to eat it in small quantities.
Absolutely impossible.
Yeah.
So this tamari coating, I don't know what it's like. We have been getting it from Macro Whole Foods.
Yeah.
And it is.
Which is Coles.
Oh, which is Coles.
Woolworths or whatever.
The salty, the umami, the kind of sweetness of the almonds.
That
like
good,
everything.
Good umami, man.
Oh my God. It's like, it's all coming together. And like, yeah, like I heard, like, you know, Barack Obama, apparently like his snack every night was like a shot glass of almonds. That's how many he goes. So I've been trying to like adhere to that rule and not have any more than that.
We bought you a pretzel glass. Are you saying we need to get you an almond shot glass as well?
I need an almond shot glass to go with my pretzel glass. So yeah, just.
Oh, geez. Yeah, they're so good.
Keep that one up there. Just before we go, where can people find out more about you, more about your work? Instagram, Behance, Jackie Winter, give us some links.
Instagram is probably the best place. I'm at Jess Cookie. That's JESSCRUICKY.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining us, and we will catch you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jess.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman, she's Laura Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by, totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more JWGYTB, archives of all of our shows and the links we've covered can be found on jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz, and you can also jump into our Corvid community Slack and find out more about that at corv.id, again, corv.id. Or you can also sign up to our newsletter, which comes out every week with all things Jackie Winter, all things podcast at jwg.is/newslettering. Again, jwg.is/newslettering. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And hit us up with anything at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, Castro, Apple Podcasts, etc., you'll be able to see links to the articles as we're talking about them, as well as other visual content as we go on. And finally, if you work for an ad agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thank you for listening. Catch you next week. Bye. Bye. From that people are willing to take from a design perspective. So look, I gotta stop saying look, it's my fucking worst thing.
Not kind of, or I guess.
Jesus.
In some kind of way.
In some kind of way. Oh, that's interesting. Look, in some kind of way, that's interesting.
Everything. There's a lot to unpack here. Sorry, now I'm just laughing at you.
Terrible.
So ready, I love it.